Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Who Do You Think You Are? The podcast series by A3 Communications, the data storage industry PR agency. My name is Fred Monson and I'm the founder and CEO at A3 Communications. In the guest chair today, we have someone I have been very much looking forward to talking to, Kelly Hoppin, originally an engineer and now DMO, a very rare breed. Hi, Kelly. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks. How are you doing, Fred?
I am very well. I've been wanting to chat with you because of your interesting background. Not only have you worked with both startups and established vendors like Dell and Rackspace, but you've also been on the other side of the fence when you were doing marketing for Gartner. So I think I can safely guess you will bring a fairly unique point of view to the discussion. So what made you move into marketing?
It's funny because I wasn't ever marketing trained originally. I went to college to be an engineer. I was an industrial engineer in college. That was what my degree is. I went to a university where engineering was sort of the best degree you could get, and that's what I wanted to get. But I never actually wanted to be an engineer. And my first job interview when I was, interviewing for an internship, my second to last semester of college, for some reason, it was a lot of techie questions and things. And I finally asked the hiring manager, I was like, do I ever get to talk to people or is it like computers all day long and coding? And they laughed. They thought that was the funniest question for some reason. And so fast forward, the day before my internship started, it was with Sabre, who was owned by American Airlines at the time. The day before my internship started, they had a reorg and the vice president of product development I was supposed to work for had gotten moved into product marketing. And he was like, hey, I now run product marketing. Do you want to come with me? It sounded like you would rather work with people anyway. And I was like, yes, absolutely. And I've been in marketing ever since. That one reorg in whatever year that was, 1999, is what changed my whole career. And so after that, I did that. I sort of made up marketing for about 4 years. And then went back to get my MBA. And there I actually focused on marketing specifics to get sort of properly trained in how to do it. And then I've been in marketing ever since.
Oh, okay. So maybe there's a question that I want to ask you, and you're probably the wrong person to ask, but you've got the right background. So you studied engineering, but you didn't want to be in it. But
right.
And, you know, there is this conversation that comes up at regular intervals about how can the technology industry attract more women in technical roles, because we are mostly in comms. How, obviously, they wouldn't attract you. You tried it. You said no, thank you. But how do you think the industry could get more women into engineering? What was it you didn't enjoy and that maybe could have made you stay if it wasn't just, you know, absolutely hate for engineering?
It's an interesting question. I didn't hate it. I liked, so I was wired to be an engineer. I'm math, science, chemistry, physics, all that stuff is what came natural to me, way more than sort of the artsy things. And so that was why I got that degree. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do the best in. And I felt like it would open the most doors. And I wasn't quite sure what it looked like. I had started as a chemical engineering major, ended up moving to industrial engineering, which is a little bit more on the business side. And, I think people aren't necessarily aware of the career paths that come from a STEM-like degree. Because like I said, mine opened up a whole marketing career path. I could have gone into sales. I could have gone into operations. I could have gone into supply chain. I mean, a lot of different areas from my degree. But what it's allowed me to do is, I think, be a fairly successful marketing executive in tech, because I understand, at least at a high level, not to the extent of the folks who do it every day, but certainly can understand and appreciate the technology behind what we're marketing. So I think that's part of it. But to get more women into it, I think it's just more awareness about what the possibilities are when you get there. Like when I was in college, all I could think was, I'm going to end up coding. I'm going to end up sitting behind a desk and coding all day and not thinking about the fact that, like, actually I may understand the product. I could go into product management. I could go into product marketing. I didn't know what that meant. I could run a consulting company for, that helps tech company. Like I just didn't have any idea So to me, that could be part of it, because I think a lot of women are really great at the skills to get there, you know, the sciences and the maths and all of that. But maybe just don't understand, like, the career path looks bleak. And I was always one of those that said, I'm going to have a family one day, and I'm never going to take a job that I resent going to instead of staying home with my kids. I better love my job enough to leave for 8 or 9 hours a day. And so it was one of the reasons why I sort of said, let's figure out what's the best job I can get out of this degree.
That's so interesting. There is someone I know, he is a blogger, but he also runs the storage team for a large M&E company.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he loves hiring women because women are more creative and they often bring more creative solutions to tech problems. And he said, but, you know, there is such a lack of applications by women. And I think you're right. It's because they are not told about the wide breadth of opportunities that they would get. For example, you just touched on the fact that you understand the product. I think that is so important for a CMO. I think the main, from my point of view, when I have a VP of marketing, I often cannot easily use them as spokespeople because the press will not necessarily like being sold or pitched. Right. Someone they see exactly as purely a marketing, a comms person. A CMO, on the other hand, very often has a very good understanding of the technology, and that is so important. And you're right, that is one of the career paths that you can absolutely do with an engineering background.
For sure. And I think women don't sign up for jobs that they don't feel like they've already mastered 100% before they apply, right? Men can kind of look at that and be like, yeah, I've done most of those things. I'll figure it out. Whereas women are like, well, I haven't done half of the job requirements, so therefore I'm not going to apply.
And I think that, yes.
Yeah. In the whole world of STEM, I think it all looks like things that they haven't done or don't know how to do, or maybe, you know, look hard. I don't know what it is. And so I think women sort of shy away from that stuff as well. But I think, to your point, I don't know that women alone are all things creative, but I think the addition of men and women and sort of all the different skill sets together really come up with the best solutions. Absolutely right.
Very much so. I am involved in the team behind Women in Flash, and it's incredible. You know, I'm just there to help on the comms side, organizing side, but there are some very impressive people there. And you look at them and you think, my goodness, you're good at your job. You really know what you're talking about. And it would be great to see more of them. When you get told about an upcoming award for women in tech, mm-hmm. you have no idea how difficult it is to find women in our industry who are actually technical to put forward. So hard. So, Kelly, if someone straight out of university came to you and said, I'd love to become a communications professional, be good at it, be successful, would you have any tips for them?
You know, I didn't come in the comms route. I came in through brand. That was my primary entry. I did product marketing and then went into brand marketing and sort of GM side of consumer packaged goods. And so comms was not something that really hit until I got into the tech space. And I realized it's such an extension of brand. It's another means of sort of telling your brand story, positioning yourself in the market. So I think coming out of school, thinking about what those tips would be, I think it's figuring out what it is you want to be in the world of communications. If it's, you know, certainly the skill set I see in my PR agencies as compared to an in-house comms executive, as compared to a blogger or a newsjacker, it's all very different. And so I think it's also just figuring out kind of which part of that is interesting, because it's a slog, right? It's a hard job. There's long hours. There's a lot of writing. Obviously, you have to love to write, love storytelling, love to kind of think about narratives in, you know, backwards and forwards and upside down. And I think that's a little different. You know, I hire writers a lot, and I realize that sometimes I have writers who are brilliant storytellers, but they don't speak the language of the audience. So they can, you know, they can academically, it's beautifully written, but I realize that it's missing sort of those key predictable phrases, value props, whatever it is that the particular, especially in a tech audience, is looking for. And other times I have great tech writers who are sort of can't rise above it and get out of the minutiae and tell the overarching story. So from, you know, I think it takes all kinds. But it's so funny when I try to hire communicators, like I said, whether they're PR, whether they're blog writers, whether they're copywriters for email, the whole, you know, range of Marcom, it can take 5 or 6 different people sometimes because the skill set is so different from function to function. So I don't know. I guess my tips would be love to write, love to tell stories, love to dig, love to find different angles, love to be willing to kind of undo any preconceived notions you have, and kind of the sort of paradigm shift in your head of how a story should be told or could be told as compared to how you think it should be told or what you've already known. I don't know, I guess those would be my only tips. And then I think there's a lot of ways, you can get there. I think starting in, operating companies is a great way to test every different part of your writing. I think agencies are better when they've come from industry before and they understand what they're doing and what the client needs. So those would be my tips, I guess.
I think they're very good tips because as a PR agency, a communications agency, we do a lot of writing. You're right. Of course. Writing is critical. And it's not just a case of you need, you know, like the techie guys, they need to know about the product, or those with a flair for writing who need to be able to tell a story. It's also a case of you need to be able to speak to different audiences, because right. if you're trying to sell to a CIO, for example, your story is going to be told in a very different way than if you were trying to convince a DBA. Absolutely. So I think that is critical for anyone in communications to be able to read the room in a way, know who you're talking to and make sure you speak their language and you know what they want to hear about. And so talking about, you know, writing and talking to people, a lot of our listeners are from startup companies who may or may not even have an in-house person responsible for PR. You know, there could be someone senior who's responsible for communications, for building the brand. You've obviously worked for companies of varying sizes. Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for a startup looking to make their mark without spending tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on an in-house team or a PR agency?
Yeah, great question. They have to appear a little bigger than they are publicly. And I think that comes from, you know, it's hard to do that for so long if you, you know, if you have a crap product, let's be honest, right? If yes. You can't, if you can't, or you have bad product market fit, or there's not a need, a really like relevant. So I think that would be my advice probably for startups, because I've come from large companies. Dell's huge, Kraft Foods is huge, Rackspace is fairly large, AMD, Gartner, of course. And news is, you know, in a publicly traded company, news is very protected. It's very, you have to, you know, you're always worried about hurting the brand equity. You're always worried about, you know, that you may alienate a partner, that you may show favoritism towards a certain customer. I mean, whatever it happens to be that's going to potentially shake your stock price or affect your investors or customers. When you're in a startup, there are no rules. You can be sort of as provocative as you want because you're not going to break anything. Your equity is so small at that point that you can say, I mean, obviously truth, but you can kind of shout it out as loud as you want. You can poke the bear a little bit on competitors because we really don't have anything to lose. And so I think that's been the most fun is take risks as a startup, take stories, like take angles that are different. And so I think that's my advice to startups is to like, don't be afraid. You're not going to hurt anything. Just get in there and make some noise. And man, if some blogger picks that up, some high influence, high followed individual, some key influencer picks that up, like it could be a game changer for your whole company.
Absolutely. And that's why I personally really like working with startups, because you can be so creative and,
absolutely,
you know, and it's so much, everything is happens quickly because you don't have 10 people who need to see a piece of paper. You can just talk to a couple of people, develop an idea and do something which is going to be really visible. Whereas with a large company, usually it takes ages and then they say no. That's right. The other thing.
Exactly, you know, right.
If something is too creative, we go, no. Let's carry on with the status quo, which isn't great.
Yeah, it circulates all the way up to the top because senior leaders care about press releases. And man, if you say anything that's slightly, provocative or...
Controversial, yes.
Yeah, they're never going to approve it in a big company.
No, they won't. Which brings me to my next point. So you said that yourself, the industry is very crowded, and it is, because as a PR agency, we're always trying to find new ways to make our clients stand out. So how do you ensure that you create enough brand awareness and clear messages so that when your sales team goes out to see potential customers, they can open those doors and then close the deal?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, the reality is when you're a tiny company, in a space that's fairly, like I said, established, no one's sitting around thinking, unless they've had a ransomware attack or something, they're not sitting around thinking, man, I should upgrade my insurance policy for my data, right? Which is essentially what data protection is, or backup as a service. And, you know, they're like, data's fine. If I haven't had a breach, it's fine. I don't need to change it, right? I don't change my own health insurance unless I've had some horrible experience. It just is what it is. And so, I think that's the reality, right? Sometimes you're having to create a pain point that they don't realize they have, or you have to somehow break through when their mind share they're willing to give you is tiny as a startup. And so the ability, like the actual willingness to listen to the entire value prop is minimal, right? They're just not going to respond. And so what we have to do is, how do we make our value proposition work as hard as possible in as few words as possible so that it doesn't take them having to read, you know, pages and pages and pages to figure out what we do. Like, they should be able instantly to know what our differentiation is versus our competitors. So that's the first thing, I think, is just making sure that someone could understand, like, why would I even entertain this conversation? Oh, because it does this, or, oh, it solves this pain that I've been having. So that's a big thing that we worked on. My whole first year was a lot of getting our positioning really, really simplified, getting our narrative really, really tight, making sure that was reflected on the website, making sure that was reflected in our sales collateral, to ensure that our sellers had that really clean, value prop. I think the other thing is a great product, right? I mean, at the end of the day, that's what's going to enable marketing to do great work. Like, I've put lipstick on pigs before, in from a marketing perspective, and had to just market, you know, some terrible or me too product out there. And that's really hard to do. I think when the product is great, great products really sell themselves. And so if we can just, you know, like break open that 30 seconds it takes for a potential customer to hear our very succinct value proposition, the product should take care of itself from there. And so that's another part too, is just ensuring that we give our product and engineering teams the right time they need to get the right products out the door. Again, there's that education piece. Part of the breakthrough to help sales is to actually give them some air cover on you know, the reality of the situation and how much data is left out there unprotected.
Very good point. So how do you make sure that your sales, marketing, engineering teams all work, all play nicely together? Because over the past 25 years, however long I've been doing this, a number of times I've seen a press release about a really good product going out at the wrong time, mm-hmm. either because sales wanted it to go out then or because engineering wanted to go out then, but it didn't make sense from a marketing point of view. And yet marketing had to bend in order to make everyone else happy. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, it may have been better to wait maybe, or wait for a particular trade show or something. But how do you make sure that sales, engineering, and marketing all support each other?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there's a couple things. I'll say three, if I can remember three by the time I finish talking through them. The first one I would say is, what I sort of just talked about before, and that I think a great product drives that alignment, right? People, sales is excited to get a hold of that product from engineering. Marketing is excited to tell that story. Engineering is excited to have their brilliance, broadcast out to the world. So a great product is certainly the thing that I think drives alignment. I think the second thing is leadership. That alignment at the top is so critical. I've worked in organizations where that alignment was not the case. And it was up to the people more junior, and I was sort of in the middle at the time, having to sort of battle it out without, air cover from the top. So I think that's a big one, but I've seen it, not work at other companies. And then I think the third one is a very real issue, what you just said. We've had situations where, especially as a startup, you want to be first to market, right? You have to be as a startup. You have to be, like, there's not a lot of startups that are sort of just me too products. Most of them, it's because they want some sort of first mover advantage out in the market. And in doing that, you word gets out, technology progresses. And even if the product is not quite available or limited availability, we sort of feel this pressure to be first to market. The challenge for marketing, to your point, is when the product is actually completely ready, available, tested, sales has been trained, collateral is out, website is up, all the things that you need to properly launch a product. There's no news to share because we gave the news away when we launched it, or when we announced it 2 months earlier or whatever it is. And so there's a little bit of, then sales doesn't get that benefit of sort of market momentum because they're actually now going out to sell it 2 months after it was announced. And engineering gets nervous that we're announcing something that's not quite finished or is still going through testing or is still in beta. So to your point, yeah, I mean, having all of those aligned and having the right timing to where you can line it up, it's rare, right? You have the audience at, let's say, AWS reInvent. You want to announce at reInvent your big AWS news. But if that thing doesn't come out for a couple months, you miss your window if you wait. There's a constant challenge. And again, in a publicly traded large company, I don't know that you have the freedom to kind of separate those dates. As a startup, we can kind of get out there and make our voices heard and then kind of do a fast chase to get it executed. And of course, we're not going to announce anything we don't have 100% confidence will be out very quickly. But, put some challenges on all those different teams for different reasons when there's a disconnect a little bit on getting out the door.
Absolutely. And yes, and working together within the company is very, very important. But what happens? So you've got that one sussed out. It sounds like you're doing a great job. How do you handle that when you also need to keep the channel happy? When you have a new product coming out, or when you simply want to go out with a campaign to attract new resellers, how do you make any brand attractive to a channel company?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, I'm a big fan of the channel just because of it's your fastest means of scaling. So we need our channel partners desperately to be able to, to be our arms and legs out in the market. So I'm a big fan of that. I think what I'm learning with channel, especially, to go back to what we were talking about in a crowded legacy space, is they need a reason to promote you over the sort of tried and true, established companies. So if a channel partner can then go to their customers who run on Google, for example, and offer an entire data suite, and their CIOs and IT directors can manage all of that data through one interface, that's a huge win for them, because then that channel partner is a one-stop shop for everything that they need. And I think they really love that.
Okay. So there's a lot, there are a lot of stakeholders to attract, to keep happy. So, and obviously it's an ongoing thing, because you know, new products, new technologies, new campaigns, new vertical markets. There's always something to focus on. But when your engineering team comes to you and goes, "We have a new product, we have a new piece of tech," and you're supposed to make the industry sit up and take note, what's the first thing you do to promote this new product?
Well, the first thing we do is figure out the story, right? Who's the target audience for this? Why should they care about this? How are they going to use this? How are we going to break through? We're realizing, like, our decision makers have always been like a CIO or an IT decision maker. They're the ones who manage the data and the infrastructure. They're not necessarily the same one who is the admin on Salesforce or on Marketo, who, and those would be the ones who care about the data protection of that. And so figuring out, like, do we have a different route to market? Are we breaking through to a different audience? Are we, you know, what's the so what? What's the, you know, 15, 25, 50, 100 word versions of what we're selling, and why should they care? How can we get a quick win? I think quick wins are important. We look a lot at, you know, where can we get a couple, like either one key partner to buy in, that we can start to get some success under our belt. We can start to get some case studies under our belt that we can use to then kind of, you know, hit that tipping point and amplify to the larger market. So that's a big one. But yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is there a market for this? And hopefully, you know, hopefully we're never building a product that hasn't been, you know, if we really have that triangle alignment, you know, you're asking me about between sales, engineering, and marketing, and product is obviously at the center of a lot of that. We shouldn't be building anything that the market isn't asking for, or that the market doesn't need. We'll say that sometimes market doesn't know what they need. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we're only building things that are great. I've certainly worked in larger companies where we get random tech and I'd look at it and think, okay, thank you, we'll add it to the website, but I'm not putting any demand gen behind this, because it's, you know, like, we can add it to a solution, we can make it part of the offering, we can add it to the price sheet, but this doesn't warrant a promotional campaign or a demand gen campaign for what we need, or we're not going to, you know, it's not one of the big bets. This year, I think with the market the way that it is, you know, I don't know how it is in Europe as much as it is in the US, but certainly recession has hit hard in the US. You know, tech companies are, you know, eliminating a lot of jobs. Companies' budgets are taken back, so they're spending less. And so as a result, you really, you know, to get to breakthrough is a big deal. And so for our planning on budget, I'm like, all right, team, we're making three big bets. That's it. We're not doing everything for everyone and everybody around the world. We need to really nail that one, you know, one or two or three big things we want to do. And let's do those very, very, very well. So that's another piece. A new product comes, we kind of figure out, like, is this one of the three big bets we're making as a company this year? And if not, let's get the table stakes, let's get sales trained, let's get collateral. But let's not put a lot of, you know, sales enablement or demand gen, promotional media cycles behind it, unless we think it's really the lead horse we want to pivot the company towards.
And that is such a good point, because the moment you put out a product or even just a press release that is not very strong, the competition will build on that and say, you don't have anything better to put out. That's why you're doing that one, because you've got that. If that's the strongest thing you can talk about, you haven't got a leg to stand on. And that's why sometimes we say to companies, you know, if we're talking to a prospect and they think they've got something to launch with, we say, no, you've got to wait. If you come out with this and you introduce yourself with that, people will not take any notice when you introduce your next product, because you had no credibility with the first one.
Absolutely. It's like crying wolf a little early whenever. Yeah, I totally agree. I think we do that a lot because we're like, hey, any little noise is a chance to launch a press release or a chance to launch a blog or a social post. We think, man, after a while you start to do all that, people stop paying attention if it's not really breakthrough. So absolutely. I agree. That's a great point.
There's so much noise out there that people can be very choosy with regard to what they pay attention to. Yeah. And I think people need to be very, companies need to be very, very, they need to have a very strong self-policing strategy in place, because otherwise they'll just lose their audiences. Sure. So Kelly, before I let you go, what do you think will be the next big development in our industry then over the next 12 to 24 months?
I think the universe is going to explode with SaaS backup. In the larger world, I'll tell you, me personally, I'm fascinated by all this ChatGPT AI stuff.
So am I. Yes.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you're in the world of writing, you know, and storytelling, and it's amazing. Now it's a little dated since it's only through 2021 at the moment, but if that can catch up and be sort of real time, I mean, it could flip the whole world of SEO on its head. It'll flip the way that we tell stories. It'll flip the way we code. It flips the way we design. It flips everything. I think it's so intuitive and smart. It makes you wonder, like, how will leaders and I don't know, educated, creative, you know, game changing employees continue to make an impact, right? The technology is doing more and more for us. So I think that's the one that I'm just fascinated to watch. I always am looking at ways to, like, how can I get on that train? And then others I'm like, oh, I don't know if it's been tried and true enough. You know, I see stuff from my kids' high school, notes from them that say, hey kids, we are really cracking down on those of you using ChatGPT to write your essays, for school. And you're like, man, gosh, it could literally, like, remove all human thinking and skills if we were to over-index on it. So I don't know exactly how to participate in it other than get some popcorn and Google. But that's the one I'm fascinated to watch.
Yes, I agree. It's extremely interesting. I believe it's been banned in a European country. I think Italy. I may be wrong, and I'm not entirely sure why. But here as well, schools have said, no, we will not grade on essays. It will be based on work in the school, because how do you police that? It's really scary. But generally speaking, AI at the moment is everywhere. I mean, especially in the UK, in continental Europe as well. It's on the radio, on TV. It's misunderstood in a way. A lot of people are scared. They think they will lose their jobs. Purely because of what it's doing. Whereas, you know, people were scared of a lot of things that turned out to be very, very helpful. Yeah. So it's just a case of using it to your own advantage. I'm not scared of ChatGPT with regard to, you know, ChatGPT being used to write press releases. I really don't think so. I mean, there are some clients with large teams, very experienced writers, with extreme level of skills, and we still can't agree because there is so much goodness there. So I really don't think that would be replaced by.
I think the thing I'm more scared of is the fact that my husband and I can have a conversation, and if I open my social media, that thing that we were talking about is advertised to me on my feed, and I think, who's listening? My Alexa, my Google Home, my phone, everything's listening all the time. That's the part that scares me. That's the other tech that's going to be interesting to watch over the next couple of years, and how much built-in surveillance there is in all of this technology and devices around us. So that part scares me.
Well, you know, it may be a case that they hear that you lost your data and you will get an ad for a backup solution. Oh. To your phone saying, we believe you may have come close to losing all your data. Make sure you back it up. So that could be
they work in our favor.
Yes, exactly.
I love it.
Anyway, that brings us to the end of this episode of A3 Communications. Who do you think you are? Thank you for joining us today, Kelly. A reminder for our listeners that you can find the list of podcasts in this series at a3communicationspr.com. I'm Fred Monson. Thank you for listening and see you in the next episode of A3 Communications. Who do you think you are?